WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our January series on guns with an international data crawl. Let's look at some numbers on guns and violence in the U.S. and compare ourselves to other countries. Our guide for this, as every Thursday this month, is Paul Barrett, author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to WNYC.
Morning, Brian. Thanks.
And listeners, let's make this one of our call-ins for immigrants from anywhere. In the country you came from, how strict was gun control, and how bad was the gun crime rate, if you know? Immigrants, in the country you came from, how strict was gun control, and how bad was the gun crime rate? Can the U.S. learn anything from your country of origin? 212-433-WNYC. If you're an immigrant with a thought about this from whatever country you came from, 212-433-9692. And, Paul, to start with the United States, I read that we have the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, and by far, 88 guns per 100 people. 88 per 100.
Right.
Number two is Yemen, 54 guns per 100 people. So such a different country and such a lower rate, 54 compared to 88 per 100 people. Then comes Switzerland and Finland with 45 guns per 100 people. Way down at the bottom of the list, then with less than one gun per 100 people, or around one gun per 100 people, a variety of countries ranging from Tunisia to Singapore to Japan and most of Africa. Does that all sound right to you?
Well, I mean, the rough comparisons leading to the conclusion that we have many more guns per capita in this country than in comparable countries is indisputable. Whether they're doing gun censuses in Tunisia or Yemen that would hold up to scientific standards, I would leave to other people to determine. But the rough point is correct. And let's just add a few more figures with some countries that are normally thought of as comparable to the United States. These are so-called high-income countries as measured by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. In Australia, you have 15 guns per 100 people, France, 32. Then you go to the United States, as you said, 88 or 89. And I think it's also worth now throwing in some gun homicides per 100,000 to show the rate of gun homicides. In Australia, for example, 0.1. In France, 0.1. In Switzerland, higher rate of gun ownership, 0.6. In the United States, 3.2. So if you want to compare Australia to the United States, you're talking about a factor of more than 30.
And what does it mean? I mean, here are some more numbers looking at different kinds of countries. The Washington Post did an article on this in December and found no easy correlation between gun prevalence and gun crime. For example, it said the dubious distinction of having the most gun violence in the world goes to Honduras with 68 gun homicides per 100,000 people, despite its very low rate of just 6 guns per 100 people. The United States, while clearly number one in gun ownership rates, only ranks in the middle of world nations on gun homicides. Honduras, very low on gun ownership, is at the top. So how telling is the comparison between the U.S. and Honduras?
Well, I think you really need to compare comparable countries that have comparable degrees of social stability, that have comparable degrees of overall violent crime, that have functioning judicial systems and so forth. I mean, you know, a lot of countries in Latin America and, for that matter, countries in Africa are kind of out of control. No disrespect intended, but their societies are not nearly as structured as those of the United States or Australia or France or the UK. So that, I think that would be my first point, that relevant comparisons are important. And I don't think social scientists, when they're measuring the state of American society, frequently use as their comparison point Honduras or Uruguay.
Another one like Honduras is Colombia, very strict gun laws, but very high gun crime rates. And Sandra from the South Bronx, originally from Colombia, is calling in. Sandra, thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thank you. So what do you want to say?
Brian, I don't know if we have the, you know, I'm not sure what kind of laws we have, but if we have them, they're not enforced at all. I grew up in a very poor neighborhood in Bogota, Colombia, and I can tell you that I could hear gunshots every single day on the streets. It was not uncommon to hear gunshots and to see the neighbors settling their disputes with weapons.
And was gun control a topic of political debate when you lived there?
No, not at all.
Do you think if the laws were enforced more, there would have been less gun violence on the streets?
It is difficult in Colombia. It is difficult because of all the political situation that we have in Colombia, you know, with the guerrillas and paramilitaries. So we have a lot of guns on the streets.
Sandra, thank you so much. And let's go to Mr. Cam in New Rochelle, who lived in Australia and Europe. Hi, Mr. Cam.
Yes, I lived. Good morning. I lived in Australia and Germany, both for about 10 years, and England for a while. I never heard of any gun violence of any kind, and there were virtually no murders of any kind either. The whole issue didn't come up, although I understand in Australia they had a problem, and there were some mass shootings a few decades ago. They did to take away people's access to the repeating rifles, which they had, and they have no more mass shootings.
Mr. Cam, thank you very much. Is that consistent with what you know, Paul?
Oh, he is referring accurately to the fact that Australia, beginning in the late 1990s, did impose much more draconian gun laws. And so far, there seems to be a correlation between the change in their legal structure and the fall off in mass shootings. But that takes us to a very important point, which is I think these comparisons are fascinating for showing how these different societies are different, not because there are easy lessons to be drawn from what happened in Australia. Australia does not have a Second Amendment enshrined in its constitution and doesn't have the same fascination that American culture has for guns. So we can see that we are different from these other countries, but that doesn't lead to the simple lesson that many people, particularly on the liberal side of the political spectrum, wants to draw, which is let's just be like them. Well, the problem is we're not like them.
But people on the conservative side would argue Colombia and Honduras may be so culturally different from the United States that their strict gun laws and high gun violence rates shouldn't teach us a lesson. But what about Finland, one of the most gun-saturated countries in the world with 45 firearms per 100 people? But there are only 19% of the murders there involving a firearm. In the U.S., 60% of the murders involve a firearm. So the conservatives would argue that, you know, the difference in homicide rates with a gun has something to do with something else, has to do with something other than what the gun laws are and what the gun saturation is.
And I think, you know, everyone is making reasonable points here, and this all points us to the fact that this is incredibly complex, that crime rates and homicide rates as a subset of crime rates are the outcome of very complex multiple variables. But here are a couple of simple facts that I think are beyond serious dispute. We have much greater prevalence of firearms in this country. We have violent crime rates that are comparable to similar countries, but we have much higher gun homicide rates in this country. And I think there's a connection between the prevalence of guns and the high rate of gun homicide. It is simply the cost we have to the freedom to own firearms more readily.
Obi in Wachung, originally from Nigeria. Obi, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you, Brian. I love your show so much. Quick point I want to make. It's amazing. It's so funny. In Nigeria, I lived in Nigeria for 21 years. I could get into a competition in Nigeria with anybody and not fear that I'm going to get shot. We can have an argument, we can even fight, and the next day we become friends. But here in America, I dare not even talk to my neighbor because I have no idea what I'm going to do because everybody has a gun. It's amazing, Brian. It's funny. It's so funny. And I hope it changes. I hope somebody changes it.
Thank you very much, Obi. I appreciate it. Isabel in Highland Park, you're on WNYC.
Hi, I wanted to agree with your guest that you cannot compare countries like in Central America with the United States. I'm originally from Guatemala, and I have no clue about the numbers in Guatemala. I don't know what's the, you know, how many people are registered as gun owners. I heard that you said that in Honduras seems to be a very low number, but most people who carry guns don't register them, so those numbers don't count at all. And the traffic of illegal guns is very high, and like your guest said, the judicial system doesn't work properly, so there's no enforcement. So you cannot, I don't know how strict the laws are in my country about guns, but it wouldn't matter because this it's like he said, you know, it's so disorganized, and there's no enforcement. It's, you know, the state doesn't work the same way as it does here.
Thank you very much, Isabel. And yet, to come back to the Honduras example, it's not just a matter of enforcement, right? Because the number of guns that are owned is very low. So if it's just...
Well, I think your guest was suggesting that perhaps the official number of guns owned is not an accurate reflection, that many, many people are armed, and the whoever's collecting the data just simply isn't aware of the prevalence of guns. But again, my point here is not that these numbers are irrelevant. They're fascinating to show you how different and exceptional the United States is. But then hypothesizing what it would be like if gun prevalence in this country were similar to what it is in the United Kingdom is, in my mind, almost an empty intellectual exercise. It ain't going to happen.
Maybe the most telling stats then are not international comparisons but domestic ones. So let me play for you an example of how people can come up with opposing data points to answer the same question. Here's the question. Does it increase or decrease safety to own a gun in the United States? And here is former Republican presidential hopeful Rick Santorum on ABC This Week last Sunday.
Well, how many people are you going to deny guns who are going to protect themselves? I mean, there are more people who protect themselves and stop violence having happened to them with the ownership of a gun than it is people who commit crimes with the gun.
There's a stat. Interesting if true. There are more people who protect themselves by using a gun than commit crimes with a gun. But here is emergency room physician Art Kellerman, who's also a gun researcher, as quoted on Morning Edition last week.
In other words, a gun kept in the home was 43 times more likely to be involved in the death of a member of the household than to be used in self-defense.
Can both of those things be true?
No, not exactly. I think they're taking different slices of different studies and pretending that the particular study they're looking at is the only valid measurement of a very complex social reality. What Santorum said is almost certainly untrue because the number of gun crimes is vast. I think what he meant to say was that the number of times that guns are used defensively, meaning that they are brandished, not necessarily fired, but someone waves a gun at an intruder, that happens tens of thousands of times a year, according to the most conservative, most careful studies. And that's a larger number than the number of gun homicides we have every year. So that actually is a calculation and a factor that gun control proponents ought to grapple with more, that surveys show that tens of thousands of times a year gun owners brandish their guns and chase off bad guys.
But what about the other stat from the ER doctor who said a gun kept in the home was 43 times more likely to be used on a member of the household than to be used in self-defense? And I've seen other versions of this stat that are lower than 43 times more likely, but still many times more likely to be used on a member of the household, especially women and children, by the way, than to be used in self-defense.
Yeah. Well, this is a different calculation. I mean, those numbers tend to come from very narrow studies of particular jurisdictions where you find that it – and I think this can be shown by these narrow studies – that a gun in the household is more likely to end up being used in a suicide or in a domestic violence crime than it is in that particular household to have chased somebody off. But those studies are not national surveys that count up sort of the aggregate number of times that gun owners at least claim when they're asked, did you use in the past year, did you use your gun defensively? You know, this can be done with statistics. You can take various slices of statistics and come up with you know, very different results. And to some degree, all of this points to just different attitudes toward risk. People have different intellectual constructs for risks. Some people do not want to take the risk that the child in the house will come across the gun, and that risk is so awful that they want to exclude the gun from the household. Other people can't imagine the situation where an intruder comes in to rape their wife or harm their children, so they're willing to take the risk that the gun will be misused in order to have it to be used in a proper defensive way. And those two views can't actually be reconciled.
Yeah, and you've been arguing that the international comparisons are of very limited value because we have such a culture of guns and gun rights enshrined in our Constitution, which is so different from anywhere else. But I think Alan in Queens wants to push back against that notion. Is that right, Alan?
Yes. Thank you, Brian, for taking my call. I'd like to make just two points. One is, since the 1934 National Firearms Act, the nature of gun owning has changed, especially in the past couple decades. There's much more prevalence in terms of semi-automatic rifles with extended magazines, and the fact that politics is able to change culture. We've seen this in drunk driving. Drunk driving was not embraced. It's not a right by any sense, but it was much more prevalent in the 60s and early 70s until national legislation came through. We've seen this change in terms of smoking. Smoking was extremely prevalent in American culture and is dropping precipitously now. And so I think that we can look at other advanced industrial countries, see what they have done, and make incremental changes towards some greater good. I'm not saying it's going to be a revolution where we get rid of all guns and be like Japan with an extraordinarily low gun homicide rate, but that it is possible to actually adapt some more progressive legislation in regards to gun ownership.
Alan, thank you. And Paul, what do you think about that? Maybe we don't want to be too fatalistic about the chances for political change.
Criticizing my perspective as being fatalistic is a fair criticism. I would just and in the spirit of the good dialogue that guest was engaging in, I would just say there's no constitutional amendment protecting drunk driving. There is no one who argues that drunk driving is an affirmative good, and very few people today would argue – even smokers don't argue that smoking is an affirmative good. They would say, I'm addicted. And weighing against that is the fact that there are tens and tens of millions of people for whom owning a firearm is not just an affirmative good. It's actually a component of their personality and their political identity.
Did you see, by the way, that a group has just formed in response to Newtown, and I don't know the exact title of it, but it's supposed to be a parallel to Mothers Against Drunk Driving,
yes,
which did have such an impact eventually on drunk driving laws, but with respect to guns.
Yes, I have seen that. Such groups have existed before just for historical purposes. It's good to point out that some 10, 12 years ago, there was a Million Mom March against guns. So we'll see more of this. It's interesting, worthwhile, but very complex.
Paul Barrett, author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun, just out in paperback, by the way. He's also an assistant managing editor at Bloomberg News, and he'll be back one more time for this January Thursday series on guns. We will talk about gun trafficking next Thursday. Paul, thank you, as always.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.